Okay, so I'm Rick Hansen, and it's January 22nd, 2020. And tonight, I want to talk about one of, I think, the coolest topics around, at least inside the frame of Buddhism, which is what in the world could be going on inside a brain, including perhaps your brain, during nirvana, or at least the approach to it. This is one of the fundamental subjects in Buddhism, nirvana. It's framed as the ultimate aim of practice. I've been leading up to it this year, moving through the seven steps of awakening that we've been exploring, steadying your mind, warming your heart, resting in fullness, being wholeness, receiving nowness, opening into allness, and finding timelessness. And the sense of nirvana and the possibility of nirvana is right at the heart of the larger topic of timelessness. So this material can seem a little exotic. And it's really useful, I think, to remember that it has been accessed by many regular people. And also, it's a fundamental topic for anyone who has any interest in Buddhism. And it speaks to the larger question of what is enlightenment? What even, to use the term, is God realization? What is the ultimate possibility of human potential as it is occurring inside our own body, particularly inside our own brain? So that's what I hope to explore with you tonight. To set this up, I have a few quotations to begin with. First, from Thich Nhat Hanh. Things appear and disappear according to causes and conditions. The true nature of things is not being born and not dying. Our true nature is the nature of no birth and no death. And we must touch our true nature in order to be free. So like so many profound teachings, it serves us to relate to them both rationally, but also more deeply, intuitively, bodily, non-verbally, with our imagination. And Thich Nhat Hanh is speaking here about a fundamental topic in Buddhism, which is impermanence. And he's speaking to that which is non-impermanent. And this particular teaching is drawn on the advice that Sariputta, a major contemporary of the Buddha, one of his probably two or three primary students, Sariputta gave to Anattapindika, who is a wealthy benefactor of the Buddha, who is approaching his own death. And Sariputta's advice to Anattapindika, restated slightly here by Thich Nhat Hanh, is of course relevant to us all, not just as we face our own last breath. Things appear and disappear according to causes and conditions. The true nature of things is not being born and not dying. Our true nature is the nature of no birth and no death. And we must touch our true nature in order to be free. In my view, this is the fundamental aspiration in the approach to nirvana and the fundamental way of experiencing and recognizing our experiences even in everyday life. Even in everyday life. So a couple more quotations. It's easy to dismiss all this as reserved for the chosen few, or those who meditate 10 hours a day or something like that. But here's the Buddha talking from his background in a rural society about the ultimate aim of practice. The ultimate aim of practice, which he calls the holy life. This holy life is not for the sake of gain, honor, or fame, or for the attainment of virtue, concentration, or mystical experiences of knowledge and vision. Rather, it is this unshakable deliverance of mind that is the goal of this holy life, its heartwood, and its end. Unshakable deliverance. So this is the aspiration. And we may be at the beginning of the path or the middle, and yet still, the beginning and the middle are informed by the lofty peaks we see glimmering in the distance, inviting us onward. A couple more quotations. Framing the problem and the solution. The Buddha speaks to us here. He says, the born, become, produced, made, fabricated, impermanent, composed of aging and death, a nest of illnesses, perishing, sprung from craving. This is unfit for delight. The escape from that, calm, everlasting, beyond reasoning, unborn, unproduced, the sorrowless, stainless state, the cessation of states of suffering, the stilling of fabrications, the constructions of mind, bliss. So we can have a feeling for what they're talking about. Many real people have explored this territory. Some of them, people I actually know personally, who've followed the traditional Buddhist meditative paths into nirvana multiple times. In Pali, the language that kind of is similar to Sanskrit, nirvana, the language of early Buddhism, nibbana, same thing, nirvana, nibbana. I've known people very down to earth. They drive cars, they pay taxes, grudgingly, but they, you know, they vote, they have mortgages, they're real. And they've done these trainings and come back to talk about it for real. And a lot of us, I think, even as we hear these words, there's something in them that calls our heart. Something in them, we feel it, we intuit it. We even maybe have an intuition of this inside our own mind, the stillness, the freedom, the deliverance, that which is unshakable, that which is not changing continuously in our own stream of consciousness, that which seems deeper than the streaming or the banks through which the stream passes. We have a feeling for this ourselves. And then one last quotation. Ah, yes. So Bhikkhu Bodhi is an American major translator of the Dharma, major teacher as well about social action and engaged Buddhism, including in terms of the climate crisis. And he writes here, what lies beyond the round of rebirths is an unconditioned state called Nibbana. Nibbana transcends the conditioned world, yet it can be attained within conditioned existence, in this very life, and experienced as the extinction of suffering. The realization of Nibbana comes with the blossoming of wisdom and brings perfect peace, untarnished happiness, and the stilling of the mind's compulsive drives. Nibbana is the destruction of thirst, the thirst of craving. It is also the island of safety amid the raging currents of old age, sickness, and death. This topic is the crown jewel of Buddhism. It's squarely right in the middle. And the point is not to hold it far away, but as the Buddha puts it, to appreciate the unshakable deliverance of mind in any moment, as the point of practice, moment after moment after moment. So I'd like to offer with you tonight some speculation that I have about what could be happening inside the natural frame. Whatever might be true about Nibbana as an encounter with what is genuinely transcendental, genuinely distinct, possibly, from ordinary conditioned reality. Apart from that, and whatever that might be, and you don't need to believe in that, and I'm not trying to persuade you about that part, because we can also understand Nibbana inside the natural frame as an extraordinary cessation of ordinary experience within ordinary reality. Okay, but whether Nibbana involves some kind of breakthrough into the transcendental or is something that's remarkable within ordinary reality, still the run-up to it and the return from it must involve natural processes, must involve, in other words, underlying neural correlates, underlying processes inside the brain. And I have for me, a plausible speculation that's been very useful in my everyday practice as to why it works, the trainings and the path the Buddha prescribed, why it might actually lead to Nibbana and even into, potentially, some kind of access to the transcendental. So I want to offer that to you here. And to do that, I'm going to draw upon the book I just finished yesterday. Oh my gosh. That's why I'm going to Joshua Tree. Literally, I put it in the mail. They all the final galleys hand-corrected the second round. They won't let me improve it, quote unquote, anymore. So that's it. So I'm very like, what? Okay, so of course we're going to talk about Nirvana, Okay, so the classic description that you find in the Pali Canon, and I want to be really clear, there probably are different kinds of Nirvana. They have different characteristics. The Buddha's description was very spare. It didn't bring in a lot of theistic language like, God or cosmic consciousness. It's really described through negation, the unaging, the unailing, the not arising, the ultimate refuge. That's kind of how it's described, not subject to arising and passing away. Okay. And there are different ways into this, and I'm going to work my way through the roadmap that you find again and again and again that's very clearly described, actually, in the Pali Canon, the collection of early teachings of the Buddha, and talk about what might be happening in the brain during this sequence, this 8 steps, essentially, that then lead to cessation and then, ba-boom, some kind of breakthrough into Nirvana. All right. Now, to be clear, for myself, that kind of classic, ultimate sequence, it's pretty uncommon in the Buddhist tradition. On the other hand, I believe it's very available to us to have, as they say in Tibet, moments of awakening many times a day. And breakthrough intimations of the ultimate that's unconditioned, a second or two at a time, or even less. I myself have not done those deep, deep contemplative trainings, often involving months or more, years potentially of meditative retreat practice. I haven't had that kind of experience, if it's indeed an experience at all. On the other hand, I feel I can speak with some genuineness about my own intuitive feeling for the truth of this process in my own experience. So being honest and disclosed here with you and encouraging you to find those teachers, and there are some of them, who've actually gone all the way themselves. I remember talking with the teacher Steve Armstrong one time. He's a teacher in Hawaii, mainly. He's done a ton of deep practice in Asia. So I asked him, naively, this is about 25 or 35 years ago, I forget, probably about that 30 years ago, can you tell me about Nibbana? And he looked at me a second, he kind of stared at me a moment, I remember this, and that he's a cool guy, and he's like, yeah, let's go for it. He said, it was kind of like, okay. And then he said this, and this is as close as I can remember it. And it seemed like he was really speaking from his experience, or close to it, and certainly he was speaking from the experience of his teachers who'd had real experiences of this. He said, well, Rick, it's as if you live your life in a valley surrounded by high mountains. And then one day, one way or another, you find yourself on the highest peak, and the view is extraordinary. But you can't live up there. All your friends are down there in the valley also. You can't live up there. So you return to the valley, but what you've seen changes you forever. And there are others like Steve out there. So I want to read a little bit to you and then open it up. So the classic description goes like this. First, establish what could be called access concentration. It's not yet the 4 jhanas summarized as wise concentration, that element of the Eightfold Path. Access concentration, is a preliminary stage in which the mind is still very quiet and collected, but it's not the full immersion into a very non-ordinary experience that is the jhanas. Access concentration is characterized by five factors: present, applied attention, quite stable, sustained attention, as well as happiness, sometimes translated as joy, or contentment, even tranquility, and bliss. So we have applied attention, sustained attention, happiness, and bliss. Bliss being a very bodily kind of experience, and singleness of mind, a kind of unification of consciousness, quite akin to what we talk about in here as having a sense of being a whole body, or being mind as a whole, everything unified all together. Access concentration. Typically achieved through sustained, solid contemplative practice on a foundation of virtue, morality and restraint, ethics, and wisdom, insight. So on that foundation of access concentration, then there's a movement into the first, second, third, and fourth jhanas. I won't give their full standard description right here, but I'll give you a summary of each one of them. And you can notice as the jhanas progress, the mind is getting really, really quiet. Ordinary thought, ordinary emotion, reactivity, it's all just falling away. I've personally experienced certainly the first, second, and of the jhanas, and had a sense of the third and the fourth. And again, here too, I know people who routinely go in and out of them, teach them reliably. Lee Brazington, Tina Rasmussen, Steven Snyder, Richard Shankman, Shyla Catherine. These are all people who've done these trainings and had these experiences and written about them and teach about them really quite eloquently. And I recommend jhana practice to you if you're up for it on retreat. Okay, so here are the four jhanas. To summarize and adapt descriptions of these steps, the first jhana is accompanied by applied and sustained attention with bliss and happiness. In the second jhana, as things get quieter, applied and sustained attention fall away. There's no longer deliberate control of attention. You are just completely dropped in. My own experience of these states is that it becomes hard to move. They're so luscious, they're so intense, it's hard to move out of it. Deliberate mental processes start falling away. You're there. You're just drawn in more and more deeply. The second jhana still has bliss and happiness, as well as inner clarity and one-pointedness. But the deliberate regulation of attention falls away. In the third jhana, there is happiness in the body and abiding in equanimity as bliss, which can feel kind of jangly, falls away. Bliss or rapture, sometimes translated as rapture, falls away. It's getting quieter and quieter and quieter. At this point, many jhana teachers have the view that you lose awareness of your physical environment. Other teachers say, no, that's not actually in the traditional descriptions. There might be some peripheral awareness of the room you're in, the sound of a door opening, but it's pretty much falling away. And in the fourth jhana, there is neither elation nor distress, neither pain nor pleasure, and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. It's profoundly tranquil. My own tastes of that have been like give a sense of a vastness and a tranquility. That's kind of sublime. It's like, wow, tranquility, really. And then on that foundation, in the classic description, there are four more steps. I have not experienced these, and I know people who routinely have trained in them and moved in and out of them. And they're described in ways that are, these were known to the Buddha at his time. Deep meditative, non-ordinary, like really non-ordinary states of consciousness, we just kind of have to imagine what they might possibly mean. So you move through four. First is the base of infinite space, whatever that is. And then you move into the base of infinite consciousness, whatever that is. And then the base of nothing, then into nothingness. And at each stage, the way it's described, is you become aware of very subtle forms of contraction, and you release that and move then into the next jhana, the next of these formless states. And the last one is the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Again, whatever that is. And then in the description, this moves into cessation. Cessation. And then Nibbana. So you see the progression? You know, you train, your mind gets very deep, very quiet. You move through these very non-ordinary states, yet still kind of sort of normal, the form jhanas and the wise concentration element of the Eightfold Path. And then you move into these whatever, like not very non-ordinary states, and then there's a cessation. And I've known people who have talked about it. It's as if they say, it's very weird to describe. It's like you're there, but you're not there. And then you, after a while, you're there again. And, you know, you realize that 2 hours have passed or 2 minutes have passed. But there's a clear sense of cessation. And on the return from cessation, you can watch the ordinary mind starting to, mechanistically construct itself, which is actually where a lot of the most valuable insights come. People who've written about this well are Kula Dasa in his book, The Mind Illuminated. Another, in my view, excellent book about this is Doug Kraft's book, Buddha's Map, where they talk through this and they talk through what it's like to come back from cessation, to come back from Nibbana, and watch your mind remaking itself, which gives you increasingly a sense of kind of disenchantment about it. You realize how sort of arbitrary and constructed and almost mechanistic it is, and so you don't identify with it so much. It kind of breaks that chain of identification. That's a major factor of craving. That's one of the major benefits of it. That's how they talk about it. And I encourage you to check out their works. They're clearly not Looney Tunes. Kula Dasa is a PhD neuroscientist. Doug Kraft, very rational. Seems like an engineer, an IT person, you know. This is not way out there new age stuff. Okay? So what could be happening in the brain? And I'm going to read you a thing and then hear what you have to say about it. In this movement through the form and formless jhanas, thought, focused attention, pleasure and pain, perception and even non-perception, all gradually disperse. The heart keeps beating, and assemblies continue to form in the deep architecture of the nervous system. But in the brain's substrates of consciousness, eddies of information swirl apart, along with the neural assemblies that represent them. Signals drop out, stage by stage, leaving only fertile noise. Conditioned, unfree patterns disperse. At the ultimate point, there is mostly, if not entirely, unconditioned mental and neural possibility. Unconditioned. Other paths and practices and other traditions might also lead to this point. Profoundly open, continually in the emergence of the present moment before conditioning. Immersed in what is unconditioned. Immersed in what is unconditioned in the nervous system as conditioned signals drop out. There's only fertile noise, quivering with possibility, ready to represent something, but effectively unconditioned in the neural substrates of consciousness, able to represent anything. This could be so like the transcendental that there is an opening into it. Freed from the ordinary mind, we could open into what is beyond ordinary reality. That's what I think happens. Bhikkhu Bodhi writes, through the practice of the Buddha's path, the practitioner arrives at the true knowledge of conditioned phenomena, which disables the generation of active compounded, conditioned, constructed experiences. Putting an end to the constructing of conditioned reality and opening the door to the deathless, the unconditioned, which is Nibbana, the final liberation from impermanence and suffering. And then to finish, I write, while the transcendental may be timeless, time continues for the body. Eventually, eddies of information begin to gather again in the neural streaming of consciousness. There can be profound insights into the nature of the mind and perhaps reality itself. For example, the words of Thich Nhat Hanh are worth hearing again. Things appear and disappear according to causes and conditions. The true nature of things is not being born and not dying. Our true nature is the nature of no birth and no death, and we must touch our true nature in order to be free. My own conviction is that the mind and the universe have the same deep nature, to be emergent, empty, and full of possibility. Within ordinary reality, this is our own nature always, and our true nature opens into vast mystery. An experience is an eddy through the mind, a body is an eddy through matter, and a person is an eddy through allness. Eddies in streams. Things arise, snowflakes and stars, people and relationships, joys and sorrows, and always pass away. Yet the streams they pass through and the nature of these streams endure. The streaming and its nature are our ground and refuge. Abiding is the streaming, resting in the unconditioned. As Zen Master Hakuin wrote, pointing directly at the mind, see your own nature and become Buddha. Oh. Okay. Went for it. What do you make of all that? What's your take? Yeah, you want to maybe have the mic back there? Great.
I think it's really interesting, the use of the negative to describe as best one can something that is kind of indescribable.
Yeah.
And that in that way, just like with paradox, that we're allowed a kind of, it's like not trying to confine the concept even.
Yeah.
Because words will do that, you know. So that was cool.
Thank you. Yeah. Great, back there. Oh, in that sense. Yeah, do you want to use the mic if that's okay? Okay. Oh, sure. Eddies are for me almost like a technical term. There's a speaker there, so I stand here this less that. Hopefully not too close to you, but anyway. I just mean it as any swirling patterning. And I have a little time on rivers, but, you know, not enough to really know enough. But I just think of it as any kind of swirl, like a cloud is an eddy. In the atmosphere, it's not bad. A thought is an eddy in the streaming of consciousness.
You know, it's gonna spin and then kind of spin out, just dissipate.
I think of it as any kind of patterning that comes together for a time and then disperses. And it's become a very fundamental metaphor, and to appreciate that, like patterns in relationships can be kind of stuck eddies, right? And big mountains or a planet is like a certain kind of eddy, you know, moving through the quantum foam, in effect. You know, that's kind of how I mean it. So I'm neutral. Some eddies are good, some eddies are bad. I think of my own body as a 67-year-old eddy in the stream. You know? that I hope will hang around a little longer at least. Okay, at least it's enough time to get to Joshua Tree. Okay, over there. But yeah, thank you. And it's really helpful to appreciate. And key point, all eddies have the same nature. Eddies of thought and eddies of matter. Mind and matter has the same nature. A thought and, you know, an atom have the same nature. It's just wild to realize, you know, impermanent, made of parts, dependently arising, and empty of absolute existence. You know, they exist in relationship to all other things. Like, wow, you know. So I have a little saying, love the eddy and be the stream. You know, open into the stream, yeah. Okay.
I was just wondering if these authors that you have talked about talk about death at all, and are we theoretically all going to nirvana kind of no matter what? Like, are we gonna feel it at some point? Like, do they feel like we're kind of separate from these sort of temporal bodies, or have people talked about that?
You bet. A lot of people have talked about it, and a lot of people have argued about it. And, you know, I try to stay out of the argument about it. And you know, I think there are different ways to understand it. I've had teachers I respect a lot be really blunt. They say, look, Rick, you know, experiences occur until they stop, and we just have to deal with it. Wow. You know? It's like, this is all there is. There ain't no heaven. There ain't no hell. You know, there ain't no happy Santa Claus in the sky. It's like, deal with it. Like, whoa, okay, bare bones Buddhism, just in your face. And I'm good. I'm like, okay, all right, all right, all right, all right, all right, all right. And, you know, the Buddha definitely really tried to undermine people's attachment to sentimental fantasies and credulous beliefs to kind of bring them again and again to their own responsibility for their own practice. And I think that's great. That's, to me, respectable in a teacher. And so I don't know. A kind of classic view is that something associates to a particular life, and then as the body dies, that mysterious collection of tendencies gradually coalesces around another body of some kind, body after body after body, and then eventually when the causes and conditions that lead to that rebirth process, that recoalescing, eventually fade, then there's no more rebirth and there's no more exposure to conditioned reality and the suffering that can come with it. That's kind of a view. To being really, my own sense of this, why not? I could be totally wrong too. My own sense of that, honestly, to me there are two. Because I'm a list maker. It's like there are three refuges. Like, level one, no small thing, is to really disengage from conditioned habits of mind, conditioned reactions, and to draw on these teachings and these tools in a really down-to-earth way, to not be so uptight in traffic or quarrelsome or faster, just to disengage from worries, you know, just disengage and engage in or rest in more just spaciousness, awareness, presence that is relatively unchanging through its changes past. Changing thoughts, changing feelings past. That's great. If that was all I'd ever learned from my teachers along the way, I would just be so happy about that. You know, one of those teachers along the way said that with practice, this world is purgatory. Without practice, it's hell. he was one of those in-your-face teachers, but anyway. Okay, second, and this, it's like it's hard to talk about it because as soon as you talk about it, you're separated from it. But it's to get a feeling of what you can know is true, which is that we are all just mind-body processes. We are a person process patterning reality, in effect. Much as a wave or a ripple patterns the river it moves through, but the river itself is always the river. In much the same way, each person we are and everything else, a cloud, a stone, a string of spaghetti, you know, is a kind of patterning of reality. And if you have a feeling that you're always simply reality, you're always reality, just a local patterning of it, then even if your local patterning disperses, you've always had a sense of connection with and abiding as reality altogether, much as the metaphor waves, individual waves in an ocean. But if the waves have a sense of just being oceaning, operating locally, then it's not so sad when the waves disperse, right? And we can feel that way about others too. And that's very real for me, that sense. Like, and then it can draw you in almost an ecstatic gratitude for like being a wave at all, you know? Or being a human wave, as bad as it can be sometimes, rather than a doorknob or a mosquito. Which are also eddies in the stream of reality, but for me, not as favorable. And then ultimately, for myself, without trying to preach it all about it or persuade, because this can get controversial and tricky, I practice a lot to feel more and more accessible to my genuine sense of the transcendental, so that even when this body disperses, I hope to remain in contact with the transcendental as I experience it and understand it in that process. That's meaningful for me. Many people practice for the purpose of that third level too. And I want to honor that and include that, even though in Western Buddhism it's almost a secret or a taboo. And I just think that's discriminatory in a weird kind of way. We should include that for those who care about it without pushing it on those who don't, who want to stay entirely inside a kind of secular agnostic frame. But for me, without a doubt, it's so cool to do these very well-designed, very crafted, very logical to me, you know, very psychological actually, very natural, grounded in the way the body works, practices to become more and more porous or transparent to the infinite. And part of what gives me hope about that is the example of people who are farther along, and really when you hang out around them, you really feel like some kind of something, love, consciousness, light, they're just more and more accessible to. And and maybe let me do this, I'll just read one last few sentences that are kind of a way about this, you know, in regular life, what our opportunity is. When we're not distracted, we're not swept away, you know, we actually are in the present. That's where we can practice and be in this way. What's the point of it all? Hang on a second. I should have found it. Thank you for being patient. I didn't have this organized. Well, I'll just say it this way then. Because you can feel more and more, and you feel this around people, for me, at least you read their words, you hang out with them, the people who are the most enlightened, the farthest along, whoever they are for you, you know? A way of describing them that I experience in a way of being I'm trying to help myself, we can help ourselves grow into, is to feel almost as if the back of you is rested in unconditioned possibility, always just before actuality occurs, right? Conditioned actuality is what's happening, but what's always just before it? So you start to feel more and more kind of like part of you sort of rests in that sense of possibility, maybe with a sense of consciousness and even love that's not entirely your own, while the front of you is receiving or living into ordinary reality continuously. Got the back of you in the unconditioned, the front of you receiving the conditioned moment by moment by moment. And if you have a sense of that for 1 second, that's pretty good. And then more seconds, adding up, you know, moments of awakening over the course of the day. In 2 weeks, I'll talk about applying this more in everyday life, both within kind of the natural frame as well as for those who care about it, and opening more into the potential unconditioned, the potentially transcendentally unconditioned. So I'll talk more about this in terms of applications in 2 weeks when I come back. But meanwhile, why don't we just sit for a minute, let it sort of sink in. You know, just have a sense of, for me, the most direct and logical attribute of the transcendental is unconditioned possibility. You might have a sense of possibility always just before the present moment. How about we just sit for a minute? Thank you very much. Take good care. Just be your own true nature. It's easy, right? You always are it anyway.